From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For decades now, novelist and famed travel writer Paul Theroux has taken Americans on journeys through the exotic and wild, from his breakthrough first travel book, The Great Railway Bazaar, to the emotionally explosive destruction of a tropical utopia in the Mosquito Coast, to his north-south overland sojourn across Africa in Dark Star Safari. Theroux's writing reaches to the farthest points on the globe, to the deep recesses of human nature, seedy and sublime. Now, Paul Theroux is traveling inward. His new novel, Blinding Light, is a dark exploration of the desperate personal journey of a middle-aged man, Slade Steadman, a travel writer, paunchy with success, empty of inspiration, hungry for insight. He travels to Ecuador, searching for a jungle drug, one that brings dazzling insight, but also blindness. But going blind plunges Steadman into a borderless world, his own internal terrain, and on a journey through his own sexual and psychological history. For a powerful writer like Paul Theroux, wandering the vast cities of the interior may be the greatest adventure yet. Tonight on Point, novelist Paul Theroux, and searching for inspiration in sex, drugs, and blindness. You can join the conversation. Are you ready to go interior with this famous world traveler? And are journeys of the mind more luminous than any exotic trek? Or does traveling across the state, across the country, around the world still inspire you? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from New York is Paul Theroux. He's the best-selling author of over 30 books of fiction, nonfiction, and travel writing, including The Great Railway Bazaar, To the Ends of the Earth, The Mosquito Coast, and Hotel Honolulu. His latest novel is Blinding Light. Paul Theroux, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you.
It's nice to be here, Tom. Thank you very much for having me.
It's terrific. So I wish you would just begin by introducing us to your protagonist here so we can get a sense of who we're dealing with. Mr. Slade Steadman, what a name. Who is he?
He's a one-book wonder. He's that phenomenon in America. We have many examples. I mean, Harper Lee was a one-book wonder with To Kill a Mockingbird. J.F. Powers, Ralph Ellison with Invisible Man. Salinger only wrote one novel. So that the idea of writing one novel, and it's a great book. In the case of Slade Steadman, it was a book called Trespassing, a book that I once wanted to write. The book he wrote, the trip he took, was traveling around the world without a passport. In other words, sneaking from one country into another.
Right.
It's not very hard to do. You have to sneak in, but then you have to sneak out. So going from Afghanistan, or, you know, through Europe, let's say Iran into Afghanistan, Afghanistan into Pakistan, into India, into Sri Lanka, or, you know,
28 countries, 50 border crossings, arrests, right. Escapes, illegal entries, all the rest.
All of that. That's an absolutely riveting subject. You think, well, how did he do it? What happened? As I say, I wanted to do it, and then I thought, well, I have a family.
Right. So here you are in Blinding Light. You have him doing that before he's 30. Now he's 50, and he's really at the other end of the excitement curve here.
Yes, because what happened was that he wrote this book. It was a phenomenon, as it would be. I mean, that's a book. Wouldn't you read that book, Trespassing?
Sure, I would. And I could feel you imagining having written it all the way through here.
Well, imagine it in the way that you do, looking at maps. And then it became a TV series. Then it was a film of Steadman's. And then it was a brand. It was the Trespassing brand of adventure gear, like Patagonia North Face. In fact, a competitor where they make watches and sunglasses and backpacks and shoes and stuff like that. So he's making a fortune, and he wants to write another book, and he realizes as time goes on that he doesn't want to be a brand. He wants to write this book. He wants to write a second book. He's the J.F. Powers, the Ralph Ellison, who's just dying to write a second book. And he does what people have done in folk tales, which is look for a magic potion. And goes to South America. And I thought your introduction, by the way, was was fascinating. And you did full justice to the book, which is make a deal with the devil. He went on a drug tour to Ecuador and took a drug that it give you hallucinations. And it also and took another drug that had this further prescience and second sight, but also made him blind. And in that state, he writes the book. He does manage to write his second book, but is punished in a way because, he, like Dr. Jekyll, who turns into Mr. Hyde, Mr. Hyde can't turn back into Dr. Jekyll at a certain point. Stage Stedman's state becomes blind, can't control it. And so it's, I suppose it's a kind of morality, but it, I saw it as an adventure novel, an erotic novel, and a novel of sort of self-discovery.
It's, of course, for everybody, it's delicious to have you writing it, because here you are, the writer who rose to great renown on travel books very young. Unlike him, you've continued to just crank them out. No writer's block in Paul Theroux territory, but I could feel the kind of, I found myself wondering if some part of you, as productive as you've been over all these years, envies the guy whose first book turned into a monster industry, an icon, an industry, a brand. Does something in you envy him sitting on top of that fortune from one book straight out of the gate, or is that a writer's worst damnation?
I can tell you, it's a nightmare. It's a form of impotence. Ask any writer. If you had asked Ralph Ellison, people did ask Ralph Ellison, where's your next novel? And he'd say he was working on it. He was teaching at Rutgers. I don't know what Harper Lee would have said. J.F. Powers and other people. Emily Bronte only wrote one novel too. There are examples of people, and I think in every case, the notion of writing something and not writing a second book or more. What do you do? What does the writer do if he's not writing? I mean, Ford Madox Ford described himself as an old man mad about writing. I would describe myself as a middle-aged man mad about writing. But if you can be mad about writing, but if you're not writing or if you're not publishing, that is really a trap. It's a terrible thing. It's like being a composer and no one playing your music.
Right. So what are you?
What are you doing? Who's listening? Right. Or painting pictures that no one is looking at? You need a tremendous willpower, of course, to do. And people have done it. There's lots of people who write and are not published. But then there's the person who can't write, the person who looks at a blank page and can't do it. Your question to me was, what do I think that's a relief or a nightmare? I think it's a nightmare to have a vision and not be able to set down the vision is just, yes, awful. But then to release the vision by drinking the magic potion, which is a real thing, ayahuasca, the thing that I described, was taken by William Burroughs in the 1950s. Mm. I mean, he found it in eastern Ecuador. And then I found it in the year 2000. I took one of these drug tours and took it myself. So it does release something in you.
We'll talk about that going up river, about the Ecuador travel, but I want to touch first, if we can, just on the, you mentioned the extent to which virility is important. The writer who's not producing doesn't feel it. The sexual world, the sexual life is kind of at the heart of both his problem at the beginning and his recovery is just drenched in sexuality. You describe him when he's got this years-long writer's block working on a novel, but it's not working. You said it was a reflection of himself, selfish, suffocating, manipulative, pretentious, incomplete, and sexless. Virility and writing, how do you see the dance between those two?
Well, I think there's a strong correlation between the sexual life and the creative life. I think a creative person is a highly sexed person. I often think that political figures are highly sexed people, both men and women. I think it goes almost without saying that the sexual impulse is allied to the creative impulse. I'm not saying that in any disparaging way. I think that it just it goes without saying. It doesn't necessarily mean that the person is going to be priapic and, a womanizer or a woman is going to be a man-eater. But certainly the interior life of a writer. I would use an example of Edith Wharton. Mm. After she died, Edith Wharton's willed her papers to, I think, a university. And Professor Lewis of Yale looked through them, and he found she had a very strong and very amorous nature and had a lover of many years. She had a very disappointing marriage and then found a lover. And she was Edith Wharton is absolutely a wonderful writer. But it turned out that she wrote a highly, highly, I won't say pornographic, but highly erotic novella. And it was called Beatrice Palmato. It was found among her papers. And it's absolutely amazing. I mean, you wouldn't show it to your children, let's say. But it's adult fiction. So there's Edith Wharton. So what's behind her? She was called Edith Jones. She was from Newport, very prim and proper, had a lot of money, but it had this intensely sexual nature or sensual nature. And I think that's part of the creative impulse. I think, and that's the book that Stedman is working on is called The Book of Revelation. That's his novel. Mm. And it's sort of his erotic history, his sexual history. And he sees that might be the key to his personality and his creativity.
You have him thinking virility was not just an important trait in an imaginative person, but was a powerful determiner of creativity. And then thinking of Edith Wharton here, I guess, you have him thinking women writers were no different. The best of them could be lavish lovers, as ramping and reckless as men. And woo, we're off to the races there.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, I was thinking when I said women writers, I didn't want to go into detail, but Edith Wharton is one. Mm. Actually, Edna St. Vincent Millay was another. I mean, she was full of sexual experimentation and very uninhibited. And the book, as you notice in the book, I mean, former President Clinton makes an appearance.
Yes, he does. When our protagonist is blind and highly alert to all things erotic, and the president certainly makes his screen. Paul Theroux is with us tonight. His latest novel, new novel, is Blinding Light. You can join the conversation. Are you ready to go interior with this famous world traveler? Can you imagine visions and insight worth going blind for? And what do you think of a 50-year-old protagonist searching for inspiration in sex and drugs? Is that where you would go for a midlife pick-me-up? Is that where you've gone? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with novelist and travel writer Paul Theroux about his new novel, Blinding Light, the story of a middle-aged writer searching for inspiration in sex, drugs, and, of all things, blindness. You can join the conversation tonight. What about good old-fashioned travel as an antidote to burnout? Has the world itself lost its regenerative snap? And what would you be willing to give up for 2020 spiritual vision, for dazzling insight? Would you give up your sight itself? And if not that, what? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Paul Theroux, I wish you'd take us a bit into that Ecuadorian setting as your Slade Stedman. And what a name. I mean, the name surprised me. It sounded like out of some kind of Pulp Fiction, but you push it through. Well, I don't know, or James Bond or somewhere out there.
It's a guy.
It's just a guy. You take him into Ecuador, and soon he's upriver, and we've got shades of Conrad, and by the time they're all the way up, Apocalypse Now and all the Descendants right there. What's he thinking, this famous traveler, maybe shades of Paul Theroux, as he heads into Ecuador in some recent year?
Well, he's thinking, maybe I've found the magic formula, the magic potion, which is what William Burroughs went upriver, the Putumayo River, a place called Puerto Asís, in 1953, in 53, and then went in 56, when he wrote the Yage or the Yahe letters. Mm-hmm. And he said, Yahe might be the final fix, ayahuasca, this drug. So I went on one of these drug tours.
And a letter he wrote to Allen Ginsberg, I think.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. In a book that I read in the 60s. And I had always wanted to take that trip, to go upriver. Or it's actually downriver, mm-hmm. and to start in a place called Lago Agrio, and just go way down to stay in an Indian village, and then to meet a shaman, to get under the protection and instruction of a shaman, and drink this drug. It's called the Vine of Death, ayahuasca. It's a benign psychotropic drug. So you're saying, what is Stedman thinking? Stedman thinking, this might be the answer to my prayers. I could take it and find what I'm looking for, which is the what you call the regenerative power to write the book and to have a vision. Mm.
He does that unexpectedly in the company of some very rich Americans who seem to have traveled everywhere. They've stood with the emperor penguins in Antarctica. Yes. There's almost no obscure corner that they haven't invaded. And gallingly for him, the new traveler, and gallingly for him, invaded reading his old book, Trespassing, wearing his branded clothing line that's made him rich. But now they're the companions he can't shake.
Yeah, they're a complete pain, and they're reading his book, as you say, and they're wearing the clothes from his catalog, and he's thinking, so these are my readers. This is what it's all come to. But that's what happens. You take a trip. He thought he was taking it alone, and you meet people that are completely unexpected, and he does. But that's what it happens. Those people bear no resemblance to anyone I ever traveled with, by the way. But
though they seem to speak volumes about some particular strata of American society that you're not very enchanted with right now. What is it?
Well, I think I'm not enchanted with the fact that you can go anywhere. You can go disturb penguins, and you can go bother humpback whales, and you can go intrude on the private lives of people in the New Guinea Highlands, and you can shake hands with a gorilla. People have said that. Yeah, I was face to face with a silverback gorilla. I could have touched him with my hand. Well, I disapprove of that. I disapprove of that. I think leave him alone. Let the gorillas alone.
You have him saying wealth had made trespassing simple. With money, it was now possible to go anywhere in the world. No courage was necessary, nor any planning. Is this the voice of Paul Theroux, who's kind of a traveling icon for many readers, saying traveling's washed up?
No, it's not washed up, but I do think there is such a thing as trespassing. And the book is about various forms of trespassing. Trespassing being places where you shouldn't be, going to bothering people, bothering animals, and also trespassing into the realm of drugs, into a realm of pseudo-creativity that where you don't belong. I mean, nothing is more an aid to creativity than a good night's sleep, I think. A great meal and all your bills paid and, you know, a happy marriage, let's say. But this is not Stedman is taking a shortcut. He's the Dr. Jekyll who thinks that Mr. Hyde might be a new form of life. As far as the traveling, yeah, I think, you know, they're everywhere. You can't go anywhere on the world without bumping into someone. And as a, I don't think I'm responsible for that. Do you? By writing the great
No, I won't lay it on your shoulders. But I found. I mean, you write at one point. You've got Stedman. He's up in this village, which is remote and you could say exotic, but in another way, quite awful. I mean, poor and diseased, and but for the drug, probably no one would come. And you say you've got him walking down a narrow path back to the village, and the riverbank, the rainforest, seem much more fragile and less wild, not as shadowy, but part of a captive and violated world.
Yeah, well, that was – I'll tell you something. When I went to Ecuador, I was looking for the drug in the way that Burroughs had and found it. But then I went birdwatching one day, and I put this episode into the book and went a half day's journey – into the rainforest with an Indian hacking his way forward, and we saw a helicopter go overhead, and it was a helicopter from Occidental Petroleum. They were prospecting for oil in the middle of this pristine, Eden-like wilderness. And I must say that was a shock to the system. The fact that they were going in by helicopter, it was a big Russian helicopter.
Right.
And
suddenly you're facing the chain link fence in the middle of Eden.
Chain link fence in the middle of Eden, and if you had seen any village or any town before then, they're full of drugs and brothels and guns and I don't know, you know, just terrible leaking pipe. There's no EPA there, so oil spilling onto the road. And I was thinking, well, that's what it is. That was a much worse vision than the vision of drugs is the idea. It's a violated world, and it really is. You can go by helicopter anywhere, and people looking for, well, gold in the Congo, for example, washing it out of the hillsides, or gold in New Guinea, just spraying hoses against hillsides looking for gold flakes, or looking for oil in the Arctic Wildlife Reserve. I mean, that sort of thing. That appalls me, because it is a fragile world, and it's going in my little lifetime.
Yeah.
It's begun to visibly deteriorate, not just the population, which has, since 1950, the population has doubled, but just the idea that you go to a place and you think, you see a beach and it's got, I don't know, rubbish on it, or someone's building a golf course on it, or spraying a herbicide or something like that. So that's all part of the trespassing notion of the book.
You know, of course, that's the last thing people want to hear from Paul Theroux. I mean, you were sort of the weather eye out on the grandeur of the world for so many people, traveling along with you on all your journeys. And to have you now writing about a captive and violated world, it's like, oh boy, no wonder he's reaching for that cup of the drug.
Yes, but that's the experience of this particular man who's trying to write a second book, and it's been my experience in some countries. I mean, going through Africa, I had that feeling. Going back to the country where I had been a Peace Corps volunteer, I had that feeling, which is it was not only violated but had not developed. It had deteriorated. The school that I taught in was in worse shape than it was 40 years ago. That's not a great thing. But in this book, Blinding Light is more about, I suppose, the redeeming power of health and sexuality rather than the drug experience.
That's certainly where he goes. Even at the price of blindness, he's willing to pay for what he sees when he gets there. Tell us about your own visit, and then we want to hear a bit of maybe what you took away from it. You were there, you said, in 2000. You took the...
I went there, yes, because I was there during... I was in a tent. I had a choice of being in a hut, an Indian hut, where there were mosquitoes. I didn't want to get malaria. So I had a tent, just a little tent. I was listening to the radio, listening to the presidential election and the election returns. Let's November 2000.
And they brought you the muddy cup of ayahuasca.
Yeah, then you're in you get instructions from a shaman. And this has been written about a lot. I mean, there's a guy called Michael Hana who's an expert on shamanism and ayahuasca. It's been written. Wade Davis wrote about it in Two Rivers. Mm-hmm. There's lots of scholarship on the drug. It's an absolutely amazing drug because it doesn't hurt you. It's not addictive, but it does affect your auditory and visual cortex. I don't know what the chemistry of it is, but it's been studied. So I took it. I went and I was with a group of people, and we took it in a kind of collegial way at sundown in a hammock, and then you have violent nausea, and then you spend a full night of having visions. And it really is remarkable. But I was doing that because I thought I didn't want to write about this without having experienced it. I really wanted to have my own experience of it and to put that into the book. So the research for the book was proactive, let's say. I mean, I went there, I did it, and then I synthesized that and I suppose adapted it for the purposes of fiction.
And we can definitely feel that experience running through. There's a passage here where you capture that state, that overnight high on ayahuasca. I wish you'd read it a bit of it for us here. It's on page 84, if you wouldn't mind, Paul Theroux.
Okay,
maybe
it goes
you can
like
set
this.
It up and tell us what's going on here.
Slade Steadman has drunk the... He's drunk the cup of ayahuasca. He's had the fit of nausea has passed. And then he sees snakes. He sees spiders. He sees a spider kind of rising up. And then a light beams in the back of his mind. And the vagrant light formed itself into a face. And the brightest part of it were eyes. The mouth was whiskered like a cat and partly hidden. Not a nose, but a snout and furry ears. It was the head of a lioness in an Egyptian headscarf with blank, staring, sightless eyes and narrow feline cheeks and a woman's breasts, a real lioness, real breasts with nipples like rosy spindles sucked smooth on pale skin. The beautiful beast had wings. That was the first sound he had heard, the papery wings. The mouth could speak. It spoke to him. It didn't move, yet it was insistent, calling him forward in a language he could translate. He slipped forward, just his eyes, his mind, leaving his body below him in a piled-up shadow. The voice of the lioness beckoned him toward a light. The striped headdress of the lioness was friendly. The voice was soft, the nostrils were damp, the heavy breasts were a comfort. The distant light was a friend. Even with a severe headache, Steadman was joyous with power and importance, translating the welcome in the vision of light, instantly knowing this language coming out of the cat face, its clucks and labials. The growly voice said, find the heart of the flower. The solemn message was specific to him, spoken in a tone that implied that it knew everything about him, his few successes, all his failures, his anxieties, his weaknesses, his whole secret history. He was exposed. He was naked before this intelligence, and naked, humbled, known, he felt very small, less than childlike. He was a wisp of spirit, all his substance, the meat of his being, the coat of flesh that had always slowed him, had long since slipped away. He knew he was in two places.
Paul Theroux reading from his new novel, Blinding Light, and there his protagonist heads off on his psychotropic journey. You write at one point about the drug being, for him, a necessary poison. Of course, the drug that he eventually ends up with, and ends up bringing a bunch of back to the United States, back to Martha's Vineyard, of all places, one of your homes, leaves him blind. But it's a necessary poison, meaning what?
Well, first I should say I live on the Cape. I don't live in Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah, but fair.
The necessary poison. Well, curare. The poison and medicine are quite similar. The shaman in the ayahuasca ceremony said that you have to die in order to live. It's a kind of death. Taking this drug is a kind of death. So your spirit exists where your body was existed before. So it is poisonous, and I mean, I think even a Sequoia priest or a shaman would say the same thing. It's a form of poison. You have to take it, and then in order to undo it, you have to take it too. You take it, enter these narrow portals into, you know, it's the Valley of the Shadow of Death, in which you have these visions. It's not a joke. It's a very serious business, in fact. And anyone who goes down to Ecuador or Peru thinking it's just going to be a session is wrong. It's a whole hermetic experience in which you're cut off. As I say, I was listening to the presidential election returns in the year 2000, and
it's
I quickly lost interest in that. Yeah.
Next.
Al Gore will be president, I thought, and then just tuned out. But it's sustained. You know, the word shaman is not it's not a South American word. It's a Siberian Evenki word, but they use the word pahe. But lots of societies have the shaman who's guiding the initiate through this experience. It's one that I had never had, and you know, as a traveler and a writer, my motto is try everything once.
But you make it a result of this insight so keen that a writer of all people really can't resist it. When he's on the drug, he can see right into people's hearts, souls. He can read all of their secrets. It's like the writer's version of paradise in a way.
Yes, but there's also it is. He's prescient. He sees people. He knows. First, he sees his past. His memory is accessible to him. His past is accessible. But then when he meets people, yes, he can see them in the way. The blind often develop this second sight in the way that illiterate people are very observant. People who can read are sometimes less observant than the illiterate who watches you closely or sees you reading, may not see the words, but somehow notices gestures, notices expressions in the way that someone else might not. It's turning a deficit into an advantage, really.
But it's worth blindness to him to be able to have this. Is that a sign of sickness or a sign of just how good it is?
It's a form of controlled blindness that he gets through the drug. You notice toward the end of the book where he can't reverse it, where he becomes truly blind and can't snap himself out of it. Then he becomes futile, and he's challenged by it, and people rob him, they bump him, they take advantage of him, and he feels like a victim. And so what gave him a second sight and prescience in the middle part of the novel, I don't think I'm spoiling the plot for anyone, but then becomes a severe handicap to him and a challenge. And then he's lost this ability. I think the paradox of it is that he's taken it lightly. I mean, I suppose this is the sense in which it's a moral tale. But I don't want it to be a moral tale. But I think that you can't trifle with this sort of thing. I'm certainly not recommending this drug to anyone, although it was an experience. I've been to Afghanistan. I've been to Iran. You know, I don't know whether I'd go again, but it was quite nice. I don't know whether I'd recommend it.
Maybe not twice. Paul Theroux, stand by. The new novel is Blinding Light. You can join the conversation tonight. Are you a lifelong Theroux reader? Did you get hooked in the railway bazaar? And what are your expectations when you crack open a book from Paul Theroux? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with famed travel writer and novelist Paul Theroux. He wrote The Great Railway Bazaar, The Mosquito Coast, Hotel Honolulu, Dark Star Safari. His latest novel is Blinding Light, the story of a middle-aged writer searching for inspiration in sex, drugs, and ultimately blindness. You can join us tonight. Do we all make some deal with the devil to get by? And what are your expectations when you crack open a book from Paul Theroux? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. John's calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Very well.
I wanted to thank you for the great line of guests this week, and it's a great show.
You're very welcome.
And I wanted to ask the author, I hear so often, and it's not just this author or other, you know, many people in the media who say that, who try to differentiate man as not part of nature. And there, particularly one comment that he said that man was intruding on nature when, say, we even visit Alaska, or, you know, when we explored America. It seems to me that man is part of nature, and that, you know, even though we dominate the planet, there's a dominant species on this planet, as I'm sure there is on every planet that has life. Just thought what...
So is there no intrusion that goes too far in your mind, John?
Maybe it's like, where's that line drawn at? You know, the difference between, you know, yes, of course we dominate this planet as humans, but yet as humans we are a part of nature. We've evolved, even, you know, as the most sectarian view, we have evolved out of animals into this, to a dominant position.
John, let us pick it up.
John, I'd say that of course we're part of nature. We have violated the planet. Name another animal that has violated its habitat. Actually, violated its habitat. Is there another animal? There isn't.
I'm sure if I thought about it a little bit, I could probably think of, you know, I mean, if we were...
No, you could. John, you couldn't think of one. There isn't one. Elephants eat trees, and they destroy trees, but trees grow back. We have actually destroyed, we've made places uninhabitable. The French set off 160 nuclear devices in Mururoa Atoll, 160, and it completely destroyed the reef. Name an animal that has done anything remotely capable of that. We're making parts of the planet uninhabitable. There is not another animal that has done that. So yes, we're part of nature, but we're a perverse part of it, I think.
Yeah, well, a perverse part.
We're doing perverse things, like say to the planet. We're in the way that we've destroyed it and intruded upon it.
Well, we in a sense, and we have to take your word for it. I mean, you've walked it north to south in Africa. I was thinking today, as Bush and Blair spoke about Africa and saving Africa, Tony Blair getting very fired up to try and do that. When we last spoke about Africa, you came out somewhat despairing from that walk.
Very much so, because I know that Africa can't be fixed with money. You have the likes of Bono from the pop group U2 with a recipe for fixing Africa by writing off the debt. That's not going to do it. Send volunteers to teach in schools. 40 years ago, I was in the Peace Corps in Africa, and we were teachers. And we thought, in 5 or 10 years, Africans will be teaching in their own schools. It hasn't happened. So money's not going to fix it. Africans will have to have their own Peace Corps and fix it themselves. Blair's not going to do it. Bush isn't going to do it. It's only hubris, I think, that makes us think that we can go to Africa and fix it. Maybe Africa's not as sick or as in peril as we imagine it to be. Many, you know, since Charles Dickens has a character in Bleak House. Mm-hmm. This book was published in the mid-19th century, mm-hmm. called Mrs. Jellyby. Mrs. Jellyby goes to the banks of the Borabulaga and says, you know, in a few years, all these people on the banks of the Borabulaga are going to be making piano legs. And Bush sounds like that. Oh, I don't know. Blair sounds like that to me. People who go to Africa with schemes sound like that to me.
Paul Theroux, I want to get another call.
But anyway, what about the novel?
the novel. There is that. Jeremy's calling from New York City. Jeremy, you're on the air.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for taking my call. Thanks.
Hi, Jeremy.
Thanks for putting together such a great body of work. And I was wondering, was there a particular experience that motivated you to turn from writing works that focus on practical realities of travel to a work focused more on the sort of an introspective journey?
That's a very, very good question. But I think that I've always traveled in two ways. I've traveled the planet, as it were, taking trips. And then I've taken the imaginative journey, the journey that all fiction writers take, which is the interior journey. But as you grow older, I think you dig deeper. You go deeper and take things more seriously. I think that I've always been interested in the interior landscape. Anyone would be who's an imaginative writer. But I think in this book, what fascinated me, or the subject that interested me, let's say, is ecstatic states of religion, ecstatic states of drugs, of sex, the ecstasy of it, not simply the doing of it, the routine of it, but achieving a kind of ecstasy. And so that's something that a person has to be psyched up to do. When you're traveling, you have to be your feet are squarely on the ground. When I went from Cairo to Cape Town, I always drew sober breaths. I did that. I was always in control. But I think, you know, when I'm home writing, I feel as if I achieve a kind of ecstatic state, if you will, through writing. And the man in my book is doing it by taking a drug.
By taking a drug and spending a lot of crazy time in the bedroom. He really dives.
Yes, because he believes that there's a sort of a magic to be achieved there and a kind of vision to be achieved. And I think that's true. In who we are in our secret selves is a sexual being. We are our fantasies. We might not reveal them to other people, but our secret history, our secret self, the real person that we are, is our sexual self. That's the one. That's that little germ, that kernel that's within us. We don't reveal it to anyone. That's why marriage or a relationship is such a wonderful thing, is that it can be revealed to that other person or shared.
I want to try to get one more call here, Paul Theroux. Sure. Eldridge is calling from Killdevil Hills, North Carolina. Hi, Eldridge. You're on the air.
Hello, Paul.
Hello, Eldridge.
I've always liked your particular travel novels because I remember living in New York City in Brooklyn for 19 years. When I'd go to Barnes & Noble or whatever, pick up your book, I knew it would transport me away from the usual, what I call, inner city genre. And you, when you took us to Africa, started in Cairo and took buses and scared the hell out of me while I read you. You went all the way to Cape Town, and you were very quick to point to the non-government NGOs and how they would show up in their air-conditioned Range Rovers, drop seed pellet off of the people, and then leaving them without any...
So, Eldridge, are you ready to go interior with Paul Theroux? Are you ready to read about psychotropic journeys?
This is a journey, Eldridge.
I'm an old Toledo Coast follower, so I think I can go there. Yeah, I am. And his fiction seems to pull a nice link between the travel writing and I'd like to say that the Polynesian, that the book he wrote about the happy islands of Polynesia.
That's right.
Starts out with him kayaking with his very good kayaking skills.
You're happy to be a fellow traveler there. Our time is short, but Eldridge, thanks so much for your call. Paul Theroux, we've just got a minute left here. I wonder how you find your readers making that journey back and forth between your real-world travels and your fictional creations. Do they all come with you, or is it two different bodies of readers?
It may be two, but I think that I'm one writer, and you know, in my heart, I want to think that it's two different things. That if you write a travel book, it's fact, it's solid, it's provable. If you write fiction, it's a work of the imagination. But I suspect that it's all fiction. Taking a trip and coming back, so much is left out that the shaping of a travel narrative mm-hmm. has so much imagination in it that it may all be fiction. So I think that the readers are, a reader might understand that, and that a reader who liked Dark Star Safari or The Happy Hours of Oceania would find Blinding Light a vivid and adventurous journey into kind of ecstasy.
Well, by the time you had your man all the way out of the Ecuadorian jungle and sitting over dinner blind with Bill Clinton on Martha's Vineyard in a full state of one way or another arousal, you're pulling together an awful lot of threads there. It's a terrific amount of fun, and it's a great read. Paul Theroux, we're delighted to have you with us tonight. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. It's been a pleasure.
Novelist and travel writer Paul Theroux, his new novel is Blinding Light. In a moment, President Bush and Tony Blair discuss aid to Africa, climate change, and the Downing Street memo. This is On Point. British Prime Minister Tony Blair met with President Bush today in Washington for the first time since winning re-election last month. Blair has faced fierce criticism at home for supporting Bush in the Iraq War. Today, he pushed his own agenda, including increasing aid to Africa and opposing global warming. In a press conference, the two leaders said they were near agreement on a debt relief plan for Africa. Bush and Blair also responded to a question by a reporter on a 2002 British memo recently made public that said the U.S. was doctoring intelligence to justify invading Iraq.
The so-called Downing Street memo from July 2002 says intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy of removing Saddam through military action. Mm-hmm. Is this an accurate reflection of what happened? Could both of you respond?
Well, I can respond to that very easily. No, the facts were not being fixed in any shape or form at all. And let me remind you that that memorandum was written before we then went to the United Nations. Now, no one knows more intimately the discussions that we were conducting as two countries at the time than me. And the fact is we decided to go to the United Nations and went through that process, which resulted in the November 2002 United Nations resolution, to give a final chance to Saddam Hussein to comply with international law. He didn't do so. And that was the reason why we had to take military action. But, you know, all the way through that period of time, we were trying to look for a way of managing to resolve this without conflict. As it happened, we weren't able to do that because, as I think was very clear, there was no way that Saddam Hussein was ever going to change the way that he worked or the way that he acted.
Well, I read kind of the characterizations of the memo, particularly when they dropped it out in the middle of his race. I'm not sure who they dropped it out either, but I'm not suggesting that you all dropped it out there. somebody said, well, you know, we had made up our mind to go to use military force to deal with Saddam. There's nothing farther from the truth. My conversations with the Prime Minister was, how could we do this peacefully? What could we do? And it's this meeting, you know, evidently that took place in London, happened before we even went to the United Nations, or I went to the United Nations. And so it's, both of us didn't want to use our military. Nobody wants to commit military into combat. It's the last option.
President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair in Washington today. Joining me now from Washington is Eric Rossman, who covered today's press conference for Time magazine. Eric Rossman, thanks a lot for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
There's a lot to talk about, but let's go first to this issue, the Downing Street memo. Sitting there today, did the assembled press find these two leaders persuasive in rebutting the implication of the Downing Street memo?
Well, I think that the president, who obviously this is a national issue in Britain and one that President Bush hasn't necessarily had a lot of opportunity to comment on before, and he immediately characterized it as a political act and suggesting that coming to light in the midst of Prime Minister Blair's re-election campaign There were ulterior motives there, and that was his way of his take on it. And obviously there's a vast public discussion on this. And a lot of people have their own conclusions on it. Prime Minister Blair came out, you know, with very succinct, very direct language that he's used all along. So I think that was less surprising, less fresh, because he's been addressing it all along.
Eric Rossman, a big moment here, this meeting after Tony Blair's reelection, and all eyes on his agenda this time, as opposed to President Bush's agenda that's driven so many of their meetings. What did the British leader come away with in terms of Africa, in terms of climate change? How did he do with his Bill of Particulars and George Bush?
Well, you might say that the event itself was a form of victory, in that Blair was able to stand publicly with President Bush in the White House and lead the discussion. The items on the agenda obviously were Mr. Blair's items. I don't think we've seen, or probably will see, President Bush call too many press conferences on emergency famine relief in Africa and climate change, although, of course, he has spoken about these things publicly.
Even so, it's one thing to talk about these and another to get what you came for. How much did Tony Blair get from Bush?
Well, I think there was some compromise, particularly on debt relief among in African nations that are showing progress toward reform in democracy, towards getting rid of corruption. The place that they are stalemated has to do with Prime Minister Blair's very ambitious efforts to double the world contribution to foreign aid in Africa to $50 billion. And the U.S., while having a substantial, the most substantial foreign aid commitment to Africa, about 25% of the total, has not yet signed on to the massive increase in funding that Tony Blair is proposed.
So did they muddle their way out of that disagreement today, or is Tony Blair going to be seen returning to London without what he came asking for?
I think it was certainly not a complete victory for Tony Blair. I thought in this particular press conference, the body language was interesting. The president seemed very contained in his body language. The enthusiasm and excitement and looseness that we've seen in him in his increasing press conferences since the November election wasn't really there. And he seemed at times tense in a way he hadn't since the presidential campaign, which was an indicator that, you know, this wasn't his turf, that he wasn't, it wasn't his agenda and his ideas necessarily on the table.
Doing a favor for the British Prime Minister, but not going all the way. Eric Rossman, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Eric Rossman, a reporter for Time Magazine, he spoke with me from Washington. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jupp, Eileen Amata, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Michael Garth, Marika Bukas, Yotam Barkai, and Angel Cozzelli. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.